Alright, so, to start it out, I guess, could you start off by saying your name, how old you are, and like your jobs that you had?
Okay, my name is Joe Garber, officially Joseph J. Garber. I'm gonna be 65 in December 16th of 2020. And it's kind of funny because my earlier life, I hung out with a lot of very famous tennis players and a lot of very famous people. So when people in this area, because now I'm just kind of like leading kind of a quiet, normal life, find out who I've dated, who I've gone out with, kind of the worlds I traveled, it's like they're like shocked. They said, boy, you've lived like a really exceptional life.
Yeah. All right. So how would you like describe your early life, like when you're in high school and stuff?
When I look back on it now, with what the kids have now, every day was like, I went to a tennis academy where they had famous, I mean, people will probably know who Paul Sorvino is, happens to be Myra Sorvino's father, but he's a great actor and an opera singer and very famous actor, and Alan King, famous comedians, and top tennis players like Bjorn Borg and McEnroe. And in those days, people kind of hung out with the famous people. I mean, we carpooled to Port Washington Tennis Academy, maybe the most famous tennis place in the world, and every day was, like, incredibly exciting. And it was just every day. When I look back now, when we played it in the schoolyard, I lived in New York. We would go to baseball games. Like, now, I think in this area, if you go to a baseball game or a football game or a basketball game, you plan it 6 months in advance. We would go with the drop of a hat in New York as in those days. We'd go the last minute at a quarter to six. One of our fathers would say, come on, let's go to see a New York basketball game or a baseball game. The lives were so exciting every day. I feel bad for the kids now. When I look back, I can't believe, I feel like I had one of the most exciting lives ever. And I never thought I did till I see what the kids have today. You know, and a lot of us lived, we lived more in a day in those days, and I feel bad, than the kids live now in months.
Yeah. Would you like to, like, say, describe what you did during your tennis career, I guess?
Well, when I was 15, I started when I was 14. I ended up winning the junior high school championship in New York City. I ended up winning the high school championship in New York City. But when I was 16, again, something I can't picture you, Donovan, as my tennis student doing. I got in a program where a dozen people from Holland came over here and stayed at a tennis camp, and a dozen ranked juniors went to Holland and Belgium for 6 weeks during the summer, flying overseas, being housed by famous people. I mean, I don't know people's political afflictions, but when I played on the satellite circuit, Ronald Reagan was having dinner when he was running for president, before he won, at the millionaire's house that I was being housed at. They were the Weyerhaeuser family, but that was the wife's name. And here I am playing a tennis tournament, Ronald Reagan running for president, because they were fundraisers in those. You know who Ronald Reagan is?
Yeah.
Okay. He's watching me learn how to water ski, having dinner with him, while I'm being housed to go play a tennis tournament in Washington, the state of Washington. So, I mean, we traveled all over the country. We had opportunities to travel all over the world. At one point I was 200th in the world as a tennis player. I had two ATP points, which made me 200th. But you don't think of a guy who's not famous as traveling all over the world, having dinner with famous people. I don't know if it exists today. It seems like the tennis kids have their little enclave, but in those days, everybody kind of had those opportunities in tennis. So it was very exciting. Hung out with a lot of famous people, traveled around the world, and I wasn't great, great, great. I was good, but I wasn't great, 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 and still traveled around the world with a life half the people wouldn't believe I had. In case it gets lost, I met a woman when I was playing a tennis tournament in the Catskills, and she asked me out on a date back in New York. My first date with her, she was the manager of the Record Plant recording studio. My first date with her was having breakfast with her, Bruce Springsteen, and Diana Ross. And yet, it wasn't like, I mean, that's special, but it happened to people like me in those days, if you were involved in tennis and sports. It was special, but it happened to other people like me. You didn't have to be number one in the world to travel in those circles in those days. I don't think the kid 200th in the world now has those opportunities.
Yeah. Are there any other famous people that you met?
Well, we used to play tennis at Jack Dreyfus's house. Dreyfus is from Dreyfus Funds. I think it was worth well over $150 million. He gave a lot of that to help invent the product Dilantin, which does something for the elderly people with the heart or something. Not Mylantin, Dilantin. He gave a lot of money to research. I'm trying to think. Again, in the record world where I met that girl and dated her, Diana Ross, Bruce Springsteen, Paul Sorvino, I said, used to come to the tennis courts all the time. Probably forgetting, I'm going to feel bad, probably forgetting 15, 20 famous people. But also hung out with like Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe, famous tennis players.
Yeah.
So we, a lot of people like me that weren't the world's greatest, we had great, great lives.
All right. Well, after your tennis career and you like retired from playing tennis like professionally, what did you start doing?
Well, it's funny that you say so, because making the difference between 70, 80 grand and 400,000 never seemed, not that I'm not way ahead of the almighty dollar. When I had my tennis school, I ran a big tennis school in 1985 to 88 and made a lot of money. It was nice driving a new Corvette. I won't lie to you. I have a Sonata now. It was nice seeing that Corvette in the parking lot, mine. But the difference, I always picked jobs that kind of had like a little bit of prestige. Like I was the manager, one of the shift managers in the Borgata poker room when poker was in its boom. And I'm responsible for a lot of the rules they have today in poker. And you know how popular poker is. And rather than maybe taking some other jobs, that was like a $70,000 to $90,000 job, I kind of preferred not really the superficial prestige of other people saying, look at him, but I kind of enjoyed running the room and making the decisions and that kind of enjoyment rather than a job that would have a little less of it. Like maybe taking the promotion to being the poker room director would have been a lot more money, but that would have been 80% of the time ordering products in the back room. It wouldn't have been on the floor in such a visible position. So I've always, even right now, I'm one of the managers in the race book at Chickie and Pete's, their favorites in Egg Harbor Township. And it's kind of a little prestige. So I've chose that instead of other things that might be more money.
Yeah. You said you worked at the Borgata. How did you get to like to be there?
From the tennis world? Because it's like poker and tennis kind of like really kind of, when poker first came about, U.S. celebrities. There's an old-time comedian named Jerry Van Dyke. He used to be in the poker room all the time playing. A couple of the actresses, the show's not there anymore, but famous in my day, Baywatch, the sexy women lifeguards. A lot of people used to, Donald Trump used to walk through the poker room himself at the Trump Taj Mahal. Poker and gambling and kind of like the tennis world was like a big crossover. And again, they were going to pay me something like $25 an hour in the early 2000s to be a dealer. I would have dealt for free. It was fun being in that exciting environment.
Okay. Would you like to say anything about your family, like how you met your wife?
You know something? You talk about celebrities. I met her. She was supposed to meet me at a party across the street 6 months after 9/11 in the building that Robert De Niro lives in, and we could look down from that building into the emptiness of 9/11. She ended up being set up for me on a blind date from a friend that I was a school teacher with at the time. But ironically, she was supposed to be at that party, and that segues in. That was a really fancy, upscale building that De Niro lived in. And if there's any kind of theme of all of this, rather than, I mean, you're my tennis student, and I haven't shared a lot of this, and it might sound like bragging, but the theme is we used to really travel in those kind of circles more than the kids do today. Maybe because I grew up in New York City and the tennis, but tennis kind of got you, like it was special up until very recently. Now they're like doing you a favor, giving you a scholarship. You know, I went to University of Miami on a tennis scholarship. And again, it might seem like segueing back and forth in your answer, but celebrities and stuff kind of went with tennis in those days. And that kind of always got me wanting to be where I had a little bit of a high profile. And so, but I met my wife through a blind date. She was supposed to be at that party, basically, in De Niro's building. And ironically, she's not like any of the other women I used to go out with. In the tennis world, this sounds funny, but we used to go out with very high-profile women. And I guess I realized that the woman I wanted to be the mother of my kids would really be like a normal down-to-earth. So ironically, she's very different than any of the women I ever went out with before.
How so? Like,
because she's plain and down-to-earth. I like to think she's very beautiful, but the other women would have... It would have been a big deal for the other women I dated to get dressed up and watch me practice in tennis. That would have been a big, big deal. They would have really gotten dressed up and read a Cosmopolitan magazine watching me do martial arts. I don't think she would rather be anywhere else than she would consider wasting her time watching me do tennis or martial arts. My other girlfriends wouldn't have missed a session of that for the world. So quite a bit different.
All right, so I know you retired from tennis. You stopped playing for like a lot of years. Why did you get back into it with me and Bradley?
My son got into it, and I don't care how this makes you sound. Donovan, I mean, you deserve to have a fat head. You have a great head and heart for this game, and it was a sacrifice for a while. Other sports, they can do this. Not many tennis people, because it's so much conditioning, enjoy playing when they're not as good as they used to be. The frustration kind of outweighs the good. And I gave it up for 7 or 8 years where I did martial arts because the thought of hitting the tennis ball two-thirds as good as I used to and moving one-tenth as fast was more unpleasurable than it was pleasurable. So you and my son, with great emotional and mental spirit, made it kind of twisted that over where it's still frustrating when I'll miss a couple of shots that I never would have missed in my heyday when we're training, but you guys are worth it.
Yeah. So, how do you think I affected, like, your life, I guess?
Well, even today, we had a lesson today, and you know me, I like to consider myself a genius beyond belief. And if any normal person's hearing this, one of the projects I'm working on is taking my genius that I feel I can see things in sports. I'm not a great business person. I can barely add. But when I see a golf swing or somebody throw a football, I'm almost like the Rain Man with autism. My mind breaks it up into pieces almost naturally. And one of my big, big projects is eventually maybe coaching professional football players with the kind of the way my brain sees the moves. And yet, in 45, 50 years of tennis, we just got finished working on something on the serve that I've never taught another person because they never had the shoulder strength and the mental sharpness to pick up on what you did. So you're actually taking my tennis skills and bringing them to another level. So I thank you for that. And we already talked about that during the lesson we just finished.
Would you like to say anything about martial arts? You mentioned that earlier.
Right now, both you and I go to a phenomenal martial arts instructor. His name is Sifu Joe Seitz. He lives in, I guess it's called Galloway. I always get confused with Galloway and Absecon. But I'm going to be 65. I'm a second-degree black belt in Taekwondo. And I like to brag that I was one of the worst students in the school. I still like to brag that I'm one of Sifu Joe's, the instructor we both go to now. I like to brag that I'm one of his worst students. And you might say, well, why is that something to brag about? Because there's an old saying that it's better to get beat up in the dojo or the school than the street. So always being one of the worst students in a serious martial arts class, I don't want to invite strangers to come try to meet me at Wawa, but I'll tell you, I'm going to be 65, and there aren't four or five thugs with knives right now or sticks that would have a chance at intimidating me in a Wawa. And that's a real nice feeling to walk around with. And again, the reason why I brag that I'm the worst student is it's not like I had any exceptional skills. I did not take to it very well. But as long as I was willing to get beat up by guys that were great at it, look how confident that would make me on the street where they don't have the skills. So I really believe right now people are complaining about being bullying. And believe me, I'm the biggest anti-bully guy you'll ever see. But most of those parents that say, how come my kid's getting bullied? If they went to martial arts once a week, the kid wouldn't get bullied, ever. And that's my advice. Forget about the psychology. Be a kid they're afraid to bully, and you won't have to deal with the bullying.
Yeah.
I'm proud of being one of the worst, not great at it. But still, again, being the last guy in an advanced martial arts class makes you a tough guy on the street.
Are there any, like, stories important to you that you think would, like, define your life?
Again, this may sound superficial. When my dad was dying of heart failure and a heart attack, I guess it's going on 5 years now. There's a very fancy, very famous bar restaurant called Skin Flints in Brooklyn. And again, maybe this is why I've always given up being a big money guy. When my son, who was like, I guess he was like 11, no, about probably at 13 at the time, when we were in New York going to visit my dad at the hospital every day, the owner of that restaurant was somebody I taught tennis to in Brooklyn. And when we first sat down there to eat to take our mind off my dad being in the hospital, he started to say, well, any drinks you have are on me. Then he came kind of running back and said, I didn't say a word. He kind of came running back and apologized. He said, you guys can eat free here all week, and I would be insulted if you didn't. Order the biggest steaks, the biggest prime ribs, the biggest lobster, anything you want is on me. And then he started to tell stories to my son what a great tennis coach I was. Now, some people can charge a lot of money in rich areas in Florida and California for tennis lessons, but that kind of thing is kind of something you earn. You really can't buy somebody, I mean, you can buy the meal with $200, but you can't buy that kind of feeling of that guy coming over and say, hey, your dad changed my life. It was a big deal to me to beat my rivals in tennis. I was never a very athletic guy, and your dad got me beating athletes. I was always a great businessman. The other guy saying this. I was always a great businessman. I had money, but you can't buy athletic skills. And Joe gave me lessons where I could beat more athletic guys on a tennis court, and maybe Joe changed my life, my ego, almost more than anybody else. And the irony is, I didn't want my son to be as impressed by those things. And to this day, my son, who's 19, now going to be 19, he doesn't appreciate how much that meant to me. But if you ask me if I was dying tomorrow for a defining moment, that's really a defining moment to me. Maybe more than it should be.
All right. I think that's good.
Yeah, that's funny, because Brownie don't appreciate the way like that is so important to me. And I wanted to create him to be a normal person that would not be, but I was from like an insecure family, just between you and me. You needed, you wanted to feel special or something. You know, like that's why I have trouble doing my brother's stuff compared to playing. I feel so special when we have like a great lesson like this. And I just don't when I just show up. This is more between you and me. When I give a guy a free program that I'm not supposed to at Chickie's, so I know can't afford it, but he don't want to spend the $5. He's got $30 to gamble, $5 he wants to spend on, and he'd rather look at the odds and not have the book, and I sneak him the book. And I feel really good about that. You know, I can't pay my mortgage, but that makes me feel good. That's who I am. I know it might sound a little bragging, but now between the thing we were talking about before, that's just you and me.